Can you start by telling us how this report came about? Where did it come from?
I started as a volunteer with John Howard in 1997, and one of the first things I was doing was going into the institution to talk with men prior to their release. When I was hired with John Howard, I was a housing worker, and I quickly became aware of the fact that before these men were being released from custody, it was nearly impossible to make arrangements for them to find appropriate housing. And a lot of the reason for that had to do with the fact that so many folks that are in custody right now are on remand. So they've been charged, but they've not been convicted. They're not serving a sentence, and they often don't have release dates. So when they are released, they often leave right from court, not knowing until that moment whether or not they're in fact not going to be returning to jail.
So you were working back as a volunteer in 97, and how did the report come out of that work?
Well, we realized that this was happening, and the more that we talked to people in the community about this phenomenon, the more they was a sense of shock, you know. How can this be happening this day and age? What do you mean these individuals aren't released to halfway houses? And this whole, you know, these myths about the fact that we do discharge planning and that we put things in place for people that are being released. And the more that we talked about it, the more that people seemed shocked, there seemed to be a problem, so that the problem was that we don't have this data. So it was almost impossible for us to go to the Ministry of Corrections or even the City of Toronto or whoever it was we were talking to about this and say, well, you know, this number of persons, you know, is in this situation this often, and that's why you need to help us. And so what I did was I met with Michael Chapcott at the time, was with the University of Toronto, the Center for Urban and Community Studies, and he allowed for, he facilitated a meeting between myself and our then executive director and Professor David Holchansky. And Professor Holchansky went after the federal funding, and we were able to get some money from the Homeless Initiative's money through HRSD, and we were able to do this research with Professor Sylvia Novak. And it seemed like what was forever until we were finally able to get this together.
And you spent 2 years collecting information on this issue. What was the overall findings of this report on homelessness and incarceration in Toronto?
Well, we looked at different sources of data, but one of the most striking numbers, and I know from my own experience, and other key informants have told us that it's a huge underestimate. But we found that about 900 admissions in 2003 to the city shelter system were individuals coming directly from the correctional system. And one individual who works at the largest men's shelter in Toronto says that it's probably closer to 1,000 individuals at that one institute, that one shelter. So, I mean, you know, 900's great and 1,000's great because before we didn't have anything. But I know that that number is actually much larger.
So how does that number fit into a bigger picture? How do we see that in a larger context?
Well, I mean, we can look at it from different perspectives, but if we start to talk about costing, then this has huge implications, and social costs and economic costs. But if we're looking for one person, right, so these are 1999 stats, but for one person to spend a month in corrections, it's about $3,720, whereas if we look at the cost of new not-for-profit housing per unit, it's just over $1,000 per month. So, you know, and in the shelter system, it's about $900 to $2,100 per month. So from a cost perspective, it's incredibly expensive. And giving people few options upon release and not providing stable housing creates a situation where it is more likely that they will reoffend. So it's just, it doesn't increase community safety. In fact, it puts people at risk. And a lot of individuals coming from the system have mental health issues or physical health issues, and so those costs are also reflected in emergency room visits and increased use of emergency medical responses.
So there's people who are homeless who end up being incarcerated, and then there's people who are incarcerated and end up homeless. Can you tell us how those two situations differ, and I guess to start, why do homeless people end up in prison?
Well, I mean, there's various reasons. One of the most obvious is if we're looking at the segment of the homeless population that is visible, so the visibly homeless population, they live their lives without walls. They have no privacy. So things that you and I might do in private, which are extremely normative, become criminal because they're then done in public. Things like urinating, for example. Also, people that are homeless have fewer options about the kinds of space that they can use. And this speaks to a third part of the report, which is yet to be released. It will be ready in June. We had hoped for it to be ready by now, but we're now looking at June. And the third part of that report speaks directly to this because it discusses issues around the way that spaces that are, in fact, public have been hardened and the way that visibly homeless people are not permitted to use those public spaces. Also in Ontario, we're the only province in Canada that has the Safe Streets Act, a piece of legislation.
Oh no, we have it here.
Oh, do you?
Oh yes.
Oh, lucky
thanks
you.
To Lauren Mancourt, we also have the Safe Streets and Trespass to Property Act.
Okay, well, so there you go. So oftentimes, you know, people are sweeped, and we do have crackdowns. And as people that are marginalized, they tend to be in the system for longer periods of time without having a permanent address or without having employment. They're seen as flight risks, and it's often more difficult for them to get bail. So there's that piece of it. So people that are homeless are more likely to come into conflict with the law because of the limited choices that they have in terms of their ability to survive, the visibility with which, you know, others their whole life is just out there. So that's the first piece. The second piece around people losing their housing as a result of their incarceration. Oftentimes people who go to jail are marginally housed to begin with. So they're living in a state of poverty, often deep poverty, and they're living in a room, or perhaps they're sharing space with others, or perhaps they have their own apartment. At any rate, because of our Tenant Protection Act, after 30 days of not paying one's rent, the landlord can begin the eviction process. So if people are staying in jail for any time after 30 days, which is certainly not unusual, especially for those individuals on remand, they can be evicted because of their incarceration. Some other people are not able to return to their homes because of the crimes that they've been charged with. So, for example, somebody charged with a domestic violence, domestic assault, would not be able to return to the home. Or some people end up with area restrictions. So there's various reasons that people lose their housing while they're incarcerated. But certainly the Tenant Protection Act has a lot to do with that, and specifically the fast-tracking of the eviction process.
And you've mentioned this a couple times about the statistics about the number of people who are being held in provincial jails in Ontario. I was quite astonished to read that 60% of the people who are in prison in the provincial system in Ontario haven't been convicted of a crime, so they're on remand awaiting court dates.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this connection to homelessness and how that's connected together?
Sure. Well, as I started to talk about in the beginning, it really has a lot to do with the lack of discharge planning that those individuals would then have access to. So even now, in some cases, there is discharge planning available, but the work that you can do is extremely limited even when you do have a release date. So if, for example, I wanted to make contact with a landlord and I could say, okay, this individual is being released on the 12th, can they come for an appointment by 12 p.m.? And, you know, I would accompany them to that appointment. But for individuals that are on remand, because they don't have a definite day of release, and often they will leave from court or something rather unplanned, it's very difficult to put things in place. And it's within that first 24 hours that people tend to fall through the cracks, and they often return to what they know, what they're familiar with, where they're comfortable, or where they have access to shelter. So the issue of remand makes discharge planning nearly impossible. And even for those individuals, like outside organizations, rather, that do provide discharge planning, it's really not a priority. Working with individuals that don't have a release date becomes less of a priority just because it's a less concrete place to begin.
And the other element, I understand, is that people end up leaving prison and then coming back and leaving and coming back. So it's sort of a revolving door or a cycle of
Absolutely.
Returning to prison. How does that end up working out?
Well, I think part of it speaks to the fact that there is very, very little programming available for people inside the provincial jail system. I'm not, you know, saying great things about the federal system, but I will say that to some degree, more structured programs are available. for individuals that are in the provincial system, unless they've been sentenced to periods of time that are 60 days or more, where they might be then moved on to a correctional setting, it's less likely that they would have an opportunity to take advantage of any kind of structured programming. The population is so transient that it's very difficult to run groups, and certainly the environment is so toxic that most... it's just not a therapeutic place to try to get help. So individuals often relapse if there's a drug addiction. Sometimes mental health issues will surface because of the stressful environment. And as I said, with no plans in place, in the snow, it's 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon when you're leaving the courthouse in your orange jumpsuit and your Velcro running shoes, you know, you're going to go back to the places that you are most familiar with. And unfortunately, it's often those kinds of places that had a lot to do with how you came into conflict with the law in the first place.
So what can be done to break this cycle of homelessness and incarceration?
Mm-hmm. Well, we came up with several recommendations. But one of the things that's most obvious, you know, when we started to talk with other service providers who did recognize this problem, a similar frustration was that we're all doing this pieces of this work in silos, and that there needs to be some sort of coordination of efforts. So there needs to be communication from the ministry to the city to the shelter to housing, you know, across these barriers. And one of our recommendations is that the City of Toronto take a leadership role in initiating this kind of coordination, and it's something that really needs to be looked at. Some of the other recommendations had to do with ensuring that individuals do, in fact, have access to discharge planning, whether or not they do have a definitive release date. We also talked about providing sufficient affordable housing for individuals. Obviously, we have a lack of affordable housing in our community, and this is a situation where we need some sort of specialized support in place. So not only do we need something affordable, and whether that's through the use of rent supplements for this particular group or whatever, we also need support dollars. And right now, there are some funding streams that do provide capital funds for building, but unfortunately, a lot of the maintenance money that's required and a lot of the support dollars that would provide on-site staff is not available as readily. You know, as an agency, we've been looking at ways to provide that kind of service, but it's a huge undertaking. We've also asked the Government of Ontario to look at what's being done in other places. For example, in the UK, the government provides something called a housing benefit. And for a set number of weeks, while individuals are on remand or while individuals are serving a sentence, the government does provide funds to continue to have their rent paid so that when they are released, they are not homeless. And that's something also that we've encouraged this government to look at.
Yeah, I guess one of the bottom lines is the need for social housing across the board.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what has been the response to this report? What are you hearing back from different levels of organizations, people, and government?
Well, it's been there's a lot of support within the community, and it seems that some people have been waiting for this kind of information to use for a long time. Within the city, there has been an indication that they are willing to work with us, and that they are willing to talk about ways that they can try to facilitate some sort of funding for us to be able to provide, not us necessarily, John Howard, but for frontline staff to be able to provide better discharge planning. We have attempted to contact the Ministry of Corrections, but we've not heard back directly, but we're going to be definitely following up with that.
Yes, that was going to be my next question, that you've made a number of recommendations for action. I was just wondering on what some of your strategies were in terms of trying to get those things put in place.
Well, at this point, I mean, we're going to start with some really basic advocacy work in the form of face-to-face meetings. And at those meetings, we will try to get solid agreements with deadlines in place. You know, to be perfectly honest, if we could just all talk to each other about the problem, and it's not about placing blame and who's at fault at this point. That's really not our issue. The issue is really how do we come to a solution? And certainly it's going to take some dollars and cents, but as I said, more importantly, it's going to take more coordination of effort that we've not seen here before.
Was there anything else that you wanted to add about the work you're doing on this report?
Well, you know, I just wanted to say that it's been a very exciting and challenging process. Because it's only been exploratory in nature, we would like to do more research that looks more specifically at this population and examines some of the solutions more specifically, because this work has been very general. But having more people on board would be very helpful. But having even these numbers to try to explain the situation to people, this is extremely useful for us. So I feel that within Toronto, the community has really helped, and I think will really benefit in the long run from having this kind of information. I think it also really, you know, at the when we released some of these findings, we had a community meeting, and the media was invited to attend. And at the community meeting, some of our service providers some of our service users had an opportunity to speak out in public about their own experience and talk about what it was like for them being discharged with no plans and being released from court in their orange jumpsuits with no identification and no money and nowhere to go, and what that felt like. And I think giving them a voice has been very important. We also had focus groups with service users and included them in some survey work that we did. And throughout the final report, there will be some quotes. So seeing their voice, or hearing their voice, rather, is really important for this work, and we had a great opportunity to do that.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.